It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, for immigrants settling in a new place, things like housing, jobs, and learning a new language can be a big challenge. We'll talk to the man behind a new resource center for the Latino community in Appleton. First, vacant legislative seats in Wisconsin have drawn national attention. A Democratic-linked group called the National Democratic Redistricting Committee is headed by former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. The group has filed a lawsuit against Governor Walker. Holder explained their decision to sue during an interview with the Washington Post.
Governor Walker, there are two people, two state assemblymen and a state senator who left their positions to join his administration under the applicable regulations in Wisconsin. You're supposed to fill those seats as soon as is practical, as soon as is possible. And he has made, or indicated, he wasn't going to fill these things until 2019. And so people in those districts would have been unrepresented over the course of the next year. And we made the determination that we would sue on their behalf to tell him to do his job, which is to hold a special election.
Eric Holder there. Sean Johnson joins us now with the details on the lawsuit. He's WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, talk about these openings. What seats are open?
So we're talking about one state assembly seat and one state Senate seat. The state assembly seat is the 42nd Assembly District, which was held by Republican Keith Ripp of Lodi, who resigned to take a job in the Walker administration. And the Senate district is the first state Senate district, which was previously held by Republican Frank Lissay, who also resigned to take a seat or take a job in the Walker administration. Those resignations happened very late in 2017. And that's part of the reason we have kind of this, the legal argument that we're hearing from the governor's office that he doesn't need to fill them immediately because they happened in 2017 and it's now 2018. That's sort of at the heart of the technical argument that he's making as to not filling these seats.
Right. There's some wiggle room, some gray areas in the state law on special elections. Is that right?
I guess that will be tested because normally this isn't something that's really disputed. You know, normally there's an open seat. And the governor calls an election, and Governor Walker has previously, without much fanfare, you know, it hasn't been a big deal. There's a long history of it. So, you know, what may be tested in this case is that state law says that any vacancy for state Senate or state assembly that occurs before the second Tuesday in May of the year in which a regular election is held to fill that seat shall be filled as promptly as possible by a special election. So be filled as promptly as possible is what state law says. And the governor's essentially saying that since Lissay and Ripp resigned in 2017, that the law that requires that special election is not in play here. And so they're saying that because of that, special elections are not required. Now, practically speaking, that does mean that these seats remain vacant and will remain vacant for more than a year, which a Wisconsin review actually found has not happened before.
Governor Walker and his spokespeople have given a practical explanation, too. They say, hey, by the time these seats would be filled, they wouldn't have anything to do. How does that all match up with the legislative schedule?
Yeah, that the thing is, the legislature, and I mean, there's truth to that. So the legislature we're talking about right now is rushing to finish its business for 2018. You know, the assembly, they may come back yet in 2018, but Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said that when they held their floor votes last week, that was it, that they were done for the year. And the state Senate, they have, one more session day that they plan to be on the floor in March. And after that, they want to be done. So there are days that they could meet in April or in May, you know, they could potentially be back then. But practically speaking, the legislature does wrap up its work pretty early now in an election year. And that's part of the argument that Walker is making.
That's direct session work. Do lawmakers do other stuff during the off season, spring training or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That is your elected representative in state government. I mean, somebody who has an issue with state government right now in any other state Senate district or any other state assembly district can call the office of their state representative and their state senator. And they don't have that option here. So while these offices are still staffed, by legislative aides. It's not the same as having somebody who you elected to advocate for you if you're having a problem with a state agency or a state service, or you know, you got a bad road in your district, for example. Stuff like that is all the kinds of things that a state legislator's office will hear in constituent contact. And, you know, it just doesn't have the same oomph if you don't have somebody elected there to deal with those issues.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about a lawsuit filed against Governor Walker over his decision to not call special elections for two open legislative seats. Here again is former Attorney General Eric Holder involved in this suit, talking about the motivation behind it.
You know, I'm not looking for a particular result. You know, I'm just saying, look, hold the election. Do what you're supposed to do. And that's what the NDRC is really all about.
Democrats are kind of hoping for a particular result, though. People are looking at state legislative special elections around the country, including one in Wisconsin that flipped from a longtime Republican seat to a Democratic-held seat now. Are partisan politics kind of at the back of people's minds here, Sean?
I think you could argue that it is the reason that Democrats are calling for these elections, not just purely out of a sense of purity and representative democracy, that they have an interest in getting these elections held because there's a potential that they could pick up some seats. There's also the potential that Governor Walker is holding off on calling these elections because Republicans could lose them. I mean, you just look at that assembly district that was held by Keith Ripp. That would probably be fought over by Republicans and Democrats, regardless of the year and circumstances. It's in a fairly competitive part of Wisconsin, and having an open seat there, you could probably say that's anybody's seat to win at this point. In the first state Senate district, you know, in another year, you might look at that and say, well, Frank Lissay has been there for a while. It's a pretty conservative district. Democrats have tried to win that before and come up short. But in 2018, Democrats are looking at their recent victory in the 10th state Senate district with Patty Schachner, who won a surprise victory there in a seat that Democrats haven't held for quite a while and won it pretty convincingly. So they want to hold these elections and they want to kind of seize on this moment, whereas there doesn't seem to be that urgency from the governor's office and Republicans. They want to just wait until regularly scheduled elections in November.
So we got this lawsuit. What courts is this going into? What happens now?
It's going to be filed in Dane County Circuit Court, so state court. And I mean, it's a state statute and a state constitution issue. So while this is something that has attracted the attention of a national organization led by Eric Holder, it is at its heart a state issue, and that's where it's going to be decided. So that means, you know, you got a Dane County Circuit Court that would have the first say in this, presumably. But it could ultimately be appealed to the state Supreme Court, which has a conservative majority.
And if this doesn't go quickly, I mean, it could be unresolved by the time elections roll around.
Yeah, I mean, if this doesn't work its way through, there is going to be an election in November for these seats, you know. So practically speaking, you know, at this point, Walker is saying today, the governor is saying on Twitter that if he that at this point, there's really no reason for him to call a special election because, you know, you would be looking at somebody getting into these districts much later in the year. And Democrats are saying, well, you know, at this time, maybe that's the case, but she had months to act and failed to do so. So that's kind of where that argument is at this point.
I want to check in, Sean, before we let you go on one other elections-related piece of news. Mike Haas, head of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, arguably, there's debate over his title even, but he's announced now that he's no longer going to stay there. He's not going to push back against efforts by the legislature to bump him out from his job as head of that agency. What's the latest?
Yeah, I think we can still say he is still, as of now, the head of that agency because he kind of knows what it takes to run it, and nobody else is raising their hand to do that job at this very moment. But Mike Haas is going to step aside. He won't fight the state Senate's vote to reject his confirmation last month. And so what that means is that there will be somebody new at the head of that agency. The same thing's going to happen in the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. There'd been some thought that there would be a lawsuit to fight the Senate, where some commissioners thought it was up to them to decide who to hire and fire to run these agencies, and they liked Mike Haas. But it sounds like with Mike Haas now stepping aside, that won't be the case. and that the Senate's action, that specifically the vote by Republican state senators, will stand. And these two administrators who were connected to the Government Accountability Board, which investigated Governor Scott Walker and other conservatives as part of a now closed John Doe investigation, they are going to be removed from their positions, and there will be someone new running that those agencies in 2018.
And Sean, talk about the job here. We've got a state Supreme Court election going on basically right now. We've got a big election in November. Concerns about outside Russian interference in elections. This is an important job.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, and it takes a while to learn all that. You know, it takes a while to get that expertise. And, you know, regardless of what people thought about Mike Haas, he'd been there long enough that he kind of knew election law, state and federal, and Wisconsin's place in it. So somebody else will have to kind of step in and assume that expertise. Haas said it, you know, it occurred to him that the agency would be kind of missing out on his expertise by leaving. On the other hand, if he had stayed there and tried to fight this thing in court, that was going to be a big distraction for an agency and lead to a lot of uncertainty in an agency when they have a pretty heavy calendar ahead.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to talk about a lawsuit filed against Governor Walker for his decision not to call special elections to fill two open legislative seats. You can read WisContext reporting on the history of special elections at wiscontext.org/special elections. There are plenty of challenges for people immigrating to a new place, like learning a language, finding housing, employment, and banking. Our next guest dealt with all of that when he moved from Mexico to Appleton 10 years ago. And now he's starting a group to help the area's Latino residents deal with those same challenges. Francisco Cabrera is the founder of FC Media and the Spanish language newspaper La Vida Hispana. He recently launched the nonprofit Hispanic Center of the Fox Valley in Appleton. Francisco, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you're starting the Hispanic Center of the Fox Valley to help immigrants with some of the things that you dealt with when you first came from Mexico to Appleton. That was about 10 years ago. Can you talk about what it felt like for you arriving in this new place?
Yes. Well, I moved to Appleton, like you say, 10 years ago, and I didn't speak any English at all. And I didn't know where to go to ask for information about classes or any programs out there. And don't get me wrong, there probably were some organizations that provide those resources to the Latino community, but I didn't know any way to learn about these organizations at that time. So that was the first, that was the main problem when I moved to Appleton to learn English.
And I understand then and now, sometimes the one point of contact for people is maybe the local Hispanic grocery store. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Most of the organization or businesses or any people that provide services, they used to go to the Latino store or Latino restaurants to leave some kind of information about their programs or their information or business cards as well. That was the only option to go to learn or try to find a service or a program.
How did you eventually find an English class?
My cousin was the one helping me out in here in Appleton. He teach me a couple things on a couple words in English so I can start doing things by myself. And eventually we find out that the Fox Valley Technical College, they provide English classes. And that's where I started going to learn English.
You learned English, you opened a couple businesses, and now you're starting this community resource, this Hispanic Center. Why did you want to create this?
Well, when I moved here, I didn't know about a lot of organizations And the problem was because there wasn't a Latino media or a newspaper in Spanish where we can learn about all these organizations. Because there were organizations back then, but you know how the nonprofits are always having issues with the marketing budget and stuff like that. So they don't have a way to reach more people. And back then, the social media wasn't a big deal yet. So I started La Vida Hispana, which is a Latino media company that we create and distribute local content in Spanish, used to close the gap between the organizations and the Latino community. And our newspaper right now, we're printing 10,000 copies, and we're putting the newspaper in a lot of the stores, anywhere from Fond du Lac to Green Bay, and we're sharing a lot of content about those organizations. And then after I started the newspaper, I start getting a lot of calls from the Latino community asking for resources, for programs, for schools. So that's when I thought about opening the center so the Latino community can have a place not just to call, but to walk in and ask for those informations. And also, we're going to be providing some workshops in Spanish for the Latino community based on what I experienced in all these 10 years. I learned a lot about the needs of the Latino community in here. So the Hispanic Center is going to be the organization that tried to help the Latino community with those needs.
We're talking to Francisco Cabrera about the new nonprofit Hispanic Center of the Fox Valley in Appleton. He's the founder of that center. Francisco, what kind of workshops will you offer people?
Right now, we're starting with computer classes in Spanish for adults, for parents. And the reason is because there's a lot of parents that doesn't know how to use the computer properly, and right now, I mean, you have to have a computer to do a lot of things. You can pay your bills, you can learn about your kid's grade, about the school announcements, all those things. There's a lot of people that doesn't know how to do that, and I would like to help them to be more independent and not rely on their kids translation services. And the other one is there's a lot of people in here that they speak Spanish, but they don't know how to read it or write it. And that's the reason why they're not learning English. So I wanna do a workshop to teach them how to write and read in Spanish so they can take the next step, which is learning English. And then we're going to be partnering with other organizations who wants to do workshops as well in Spanish, financial workshops, real estate workshops to help the Latino community to buy houses or to sell their houses. And but the main workshop is going to be the computer classes and the Spanish classes.
You're just starting out now, and it sounds like at this point the staff is small. You're doing a lot of the work yourself, still working on furniture, things like that. Talk about where this is at right now and how you're hoping to grow in the future.
Yes, right now we're doing everything by ourselves. Right now we just bought 30 computers to start providing the computer classes and the center. That's a huge step. And then the furniture and everything else will come with time. I'm not looking right now to buy any more furniture. I'm just looking to buy the resources that I need to provide or to start the workshops as soon as possible. I'm also partnering with other organizations to do workshops at their locations. For example, I'm going to be providing computer classes in Spanish in one of their Menasha School District locations. So they're hosting the computer classes. They're providing all the equipment, and I'm going to go there and teach computer and Spanish. And I'm looking for other organizations who are willing to do the same.
Are you looking, Francisco, for volunteers to, teach the workshops or do work around the new center?
Yes, I'm looking for volunteers right now who wants to help the Latino community in certain areas. It's hard to find right now volunteers since we're a new company. We don't have the staff right now pretty much to run the daily operation, which right now is what I'm looking for. I'm looking to hire people to start making the center better so we can help more people.
Francisco, as we said, 10 years ago, you were new to Appleton. You didn't speak English. Now here you are. You've learned English. You've got your businesses. You're starting this center. 10 years from today, what are you hoping for the center and for the Latino community in the Appleton area?
10 years from now, that's a good question. I would like to, I would like to help as many people I can. I would like to have a bigger center with more rooms to provide more workshops. And I see the Hispanic Center as a research center for the Latino community, but I also would like to have the center as a education place for the Latino community.
Francisco, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much.
Francisco Cabrera is the founder of FC Media and the Spanish language newspaper La Vida Hispana. He talked with us about what led him to open the new nonprofit Hispanic Center of the Fox Valley in Appleton. As a society, we spend a lot of time talking about what it means to live a good life. But when it comes to talking about having a good death, it can be a whole different story. Conversations about end-of-life issues can be some of the most difficult to have, to the point where some of us would rather not talk about it at all. And maybe that's why there's often a disconnect between what we want for our own deaths and what actually happens. Our next guest wants to change that conversation and help us and our loved ones to define our priorities for the end of our lives. That can mean laying out specific steps for determining when further medical care is needed and when it isn't. Dr. Samuel Harrington practiced internal medicine and gastroenterology for more than 30 years in Washington, D.C. He grew up in Milwaukee and is a graduate of the UW Medical School. His new book is At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Dr. Harrington, thanks so much for joining us today.
So, Rob, thank you very much for having me, and please call me Sam.
And so, Sam, what accounts for that disparity between how a lot of us think we might want to pass away, at home preferably, quietly, versus how many of us do after long series of medical procedures?
Well, it's usually because families don't have enough conversation on the subject, and families don't really understand what their loved ones want. And combine that with the fact that the default position in American medicine is to treat and frequently over-treat, and we end up with elderly patients who die in hospitals when they would prefer to die at home. I think it's appropriate to say that 80 or 90% of elderly patients would express the preference, or in medical studies they express a preference to die quietly at home, but 60% of them die in institutions because of the lack of this conversation.
Quoting from your book here, it's the duty of the physician to sustain life and relieve suffering. And Sam, I think a lot of times those go hand in hand. It's the same thing in many conditions. But when we're talking about end-of-life care, sometimes relieving suffering and sustaining life are opposites.
That is correct. They are. They frequently at the end of life sustaining life and relieving suffering are in conflict, and it is at that point that the patient or their family member has to indicate to the physician what they want done, because in principle, if we give pain medicine to control pain, we might shorten that person's life. I think in practice, we don't really shorten their life by much, but or that concept is a little bit overblown. But it is very important to recognize when that conflict is evident, and then we have to follow the patient's wishes.
You've dealt with these issues to some extent as a doctor through your career, but you start your book on the shores of Lake Michigan talking about your father and how he approached some of these issues. Can you tell his story a little bit for us?
Well, I was toying with the idea of writing the book on this subject, but it didn't crystallize until a conversation I had with my father about potentially repairing an aortic aneurysm in his abdomen. That's a ballooned blood vessel that was threatening to rupture. And he was a lawyer in Milwaukee, and he knew from experience with a client that if it ruptured, he would be unlikely to survive the emergency surgery. He was 88 at the time we had this conversation. But I had outlined a plan where he could have the aneurysm strengthened without a major surgery, sort of like a giant cardiac catheterization for his aneurysm. And it seemed like a very good plan because it would add several years to his life, and I wanted him alive to meet my grandchildren. And he looked at me, and he kind of clenched his jaw and pointed his finger and asked me, why would I want to treat something that is going to carry me away the way that I want to go, meaning quickly and decisively? And that's when I realized that it's fundamental that if you don't want to die in a hospital, you have to say no to hospitalization. And although his vision was somewhat, I'd say, naive, it was and relied on a random event, the rupture of his aneurysm. It was hugely informative to me and my sisters in terms of understanding his mindset. And from that point, that was a jumping off point for other discussions about end of life wishes. I think of having a vision is extremely important, and sharing it is critical.
Talking to Dr. Sam Harrington, his new book is At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Sam, we're all going to deal with these issues one way or another. We hopefully will grow old ourselves. We'll have loved ones who come to this situation. This is going to be a conflict in everyone's lives. Why don't we talk about it more?
Well, it's simply very difficult. Even in my family, where we had multiple discussions, it's just hard to face the facts, and it's hard to speculate on how our life will end. So all the conversations that I had with my parents were always emotionally charged, and I was familiar with them through decades of clinical practice. It's just very, very hard, and it's easier to ignore them. But I say people should blunder forward with these conversations, because the consequences of ignoring them are that we end up having our loved ones die in a hospital, frequently in the intensive care unit.
A lot of your book centers around practical advice for families, family members, seniors themselves, people dealing with chronic health conditions. What's your advice for starting that family conversation?
I think it is to take a throwaway line like the vision that I just mentioned, my father's vision or someone else's vision, and expand on it. For example, Groucho Marx famously said that he planned to live forever or die trying. Well, that's a vision. He's gonna fight forever, and that's fine. It's a good point of view. But he's going to end up in the intensive care unit. Or Woody Allen, who said, I'm not afraid to die. I just don't want to be there when it happens. Well, I was sort of like my father's throwaway line that he hoped to wake up dead. That's a vision, and you can work with that. And I think that sometimes people say things that we don't think of as end of life comments, but we can turn them into end of life comments. It might be related to what an aunt or uncle endured in terms of treatment or hospitalization. It might be what a friend endured, or et cetera. So you have to sort of look for opportunities, and then you have to seize them.
One of the most emotional parts of this, I think, for a lot of families is when somebody's facing a serious condition, especially late in life, like, say, cancer or heart disease, and there's an aggressive treatment option that could reduce their quality of life. There's the idea that if you don't take all paths, if you don't pursue that aggressive treatment, you're giving up. And you write in your book, accepting death does not mean wanting to die. How do we take that giving up emotion out of the conversation?
Well, we have to recognize that going home to hospice care or palliative care is not giving up. It's embracing a different perspective, and we have to encourage that. False hope is a complication of futile treatment, and we have to avoid that. When my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, of course, we were sad, and we did not want her to give up, but we didn't want her to focus exclusively on prolonging her life. We wanted her to focus on getting to my daughter's wedding, which was about 4 or 5 months later, after the diagnosis. So I advise patients to change their perspectives, look for something positive, and then go for that rather than try to fight to prolong their life, because that will ultimately fail.
We're talking right now with Dr. Samuel Harrington about planning for the end of our lives and what it means to choose a good death after a long life. He's the author of the new book, At Peace. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue for you now in your family? Are you having these conversations about end-of-life issues with a parent or a spouse, or maybe on your own behalf? Or is there something going on where you wish you were talking about it and you don't know how to start? What does planning for a good death look like to you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Samuel Harrington is with us. He's the author of the new book, At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you spent time thinking about and planning for the kind of end of life you'd like to have? What does that mean to you? What does that look like to you? Have you gone through this? Are you going through this with a family member? What kind of questions have come up? What kind of conversations do you wish you'd had by now? Call in at 800-642-1234. And do you think there's too much attention on prolonged medical care at the end of life? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Monica is with us in Waukesha. Hi.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for having this conversation. I think it's very important. I learned from a sad experience. My father's sister-in-law both died of brain aneurysm. And he was a physician, and he always talked about, what is it merciful for people to keep prolonging life? Well, as it would happen, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and the only treatment in Mexico was a radical prostatectomy. And he said, absolutely not. I will live with dignity whatever years I have left. And as life will have it, he had a brain aneurysm himself and died.
Monica, thank you for sharing your father's story. So he was faced, in this case, with a diagnosis, a radical treatment, and chose not to do it. How, Sam, do you weigh those? In some cases, yeah, the treatment is the right decision for a person. Sometimes it isn't. How do you weigh the difficulties, the risks of the treatment against the well-being of the patient?
Well, I think that if a treatment doesn't promise to improve the quality of your life while simultaneously prolonging it, then you have to think very hard about that particular treatment, because if you are trading a good day at home for a day of isolation in a hospital, or a good day at home for 2 days of side effects at home, you've entered a zero-sum game. And I didn't get the entire question from the caller, but I heard the word dignity, that he preferred to die with dignity in his own definition of it. And I think that's enormously important to people, to some people, and we have to appreciate that and try and follow their wishes in that regard.
Monica, thanks for your call. We'll go next to Samantha in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I like your show. Anyway, I was just saying that I'm 36 years old. When I pass on, I've already have it made known to family members and friends that, you know, it's all laid out that I'm going to be, my body's going to be donated to science, and then it's going to be, you know, used, and then it'll be cremated afterwards so others can use it. And I just wanted to say that they're saying that they need more and more, you know, donors, you know, bodies, because what do you need it when you're gone? So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there. And what do you think about body donation?
Samantha, thanks for the call. Samantha, going a little later in the equation than you've been talking about, Sam, what happens after we die. Is that something that is important to spell out for family members?
Well, it is important to spell out for family members, and I think her point is an important one. I do not touch on that in my book, but I will say that as a medical student at the University of Wisconsin, I was deeply impressed that a person donated their body for us to learn about gross anatomy, and I am very appreciative of that. So I think it's quite important.
Thanks for the call. I want to turn to another part of your book. You go through some of the most common chronic illnesses facing people over the age of, I think, 65 was the breaking point. And look at the prognosis and the development of diseases and the kind of treatments that are out there. Is that important when we get that diagnosis that we didn't want to start looking in the future, the common progressions of these diseases?
I think it's critically important, and I think that doctors don't tell patients enough about their disease, and patients frequently don't ask enough questions about it, their disease. And I think that knowing one's prognosis is something that patients sometimes avoid and doctors frequently avoid because of the fear of upsetting a patient or seeming too cold and calculating. But I think it's critically important, as I said, when my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, her prognosis was she had a median survival of 10 months. That meant that ultimately 50% of patients in her circumstance would pass away within 10 months. And at an advanced age, you're much less likely to exceed the median. So if you think of yourself as having a finite period of time, then you can make better plans about how you're going to deal with it, including, as my mother did, focusing on going to my daughter's wedding and taking comfort in making it there, for example. But we ignore prognosis too much, and I think it's in the patient's best interest to learn as much as possible.
Is that part of what leads to maybe false hope, as you were talking about earlier? If we don't understand the prognosis, we might look at a treatment and think, oh, maybe this is going to cure something that really isn't going to be cured.
I think it does. I think it does lead to false hope. And I think false hope leads to futile treatment. And I think futile treatment is cruel and wrong. Now, people have a hard time defining medical futility, but I think we know it and we can recognize it in retrospect. Because if we look at the way our loved ones died, if we look at the last treatment our loved one endured before they died, and if we then, on reflection, say to ourselves, I wish I had not done that to my mother. I wish I had not allowed my father to do that aggressive therapy. Well, we've defined futile treatment at that moment, and the trick is to recognize it in advance and avoid it. Which I think with experience, doctors can guide patients in that regard.
Talking to Dr. Samuel Harrington about his new book, At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Sam, on a practical note, there are things like do not resuscitate statements and other directives about what kind of care we do and don't want in an emergency situation. What kind of options are out there for people?
Well, there are a variety of advanced directives that people can look at, download, and sort through themselves and come up with their own list of wishes. Specifically, you described do not resuscitate as a form of advanced directive, and pulsed orders, physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, are also. When my mother was diagnosed, we determined within a month or two that she would go into hospice care and would be a do not resuscitate patient, and I was very comforted by that, because once you can avoid that kind of aggressive treatment, you know your family member is going to pass away more comfortably than the alternative. After my mother died, my father started to wear his wife's do not resuscitate bracelet, which I told him that's not exactly how we do it, Dad. It's better if you sign up officially. But he did sign up officially about 5 years before he died, and I felt that that was a good decision for him. And we aim for pulsed orders for, say, 2 or 3 years before we sort of expect a patient to pass away. Now, obviously, nobody can predict the future. Doctors are not good at that in particular, but we can have a general sense of what a person's prognosis is and adjust our advanced directives accordingly.
Are you hoping to see a mindset, a cultural change in the medical profession when it comes to these end-of-life issues?
I would like to see that. I did have colleagues who refused to discuss prognosis with their patients, and I thought that was quite wrong. And I had colleagues who were overly aggressive, and I thought that was equally wrong. I really think that medical schools and training programs should have a curriculum that includes a course, and I'm making this up, something along the lines of, would you really want your mother to undergo this treatment? And we pay lip service to the mother test, as in, would you let your mother do this? But we shouldn't pay just lip service. We should make it a part of the new mindset.
And are you seeing a change just among people, among patients, families in the United States to start thinking about these issues more, or is this still a conversation most of us aren't having?
Well, it's definitely a conversation most of us aren't having. It is but more of us are having it appropriately, and I hope to push this in from a small wave into a tidal wave.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Harrington, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for having me. It's sort of like coming home and being on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It was good to have you back. Thanks so much. That was Dr. Samuel Harrington. He practiced internal medicine and gastroenterology for more than 30 years in Washington, D.C. He grew up in Milwaukee here in Wisconsin, and he's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin Medical School. We've been talking about his new book. It's called At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life, looking at a lot of end-of-life issues, the way the medical profession treats seniors, and the way families and patients can have conversations about these issues. Still time for you to share your story. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if this is something you're dealing with in your family. The Academy Awards are coming up next Sunday, and on Thursday here on Central Time, we'll get some Oscar predictions from one of our favorite film critics. Throughout the week, we're going to feature some of the Oscar-nominated music. We want to hear from you. Tell us about your all-time favorite movie soundtrack or song. You can leave us a message at our call-in line. It's 833-424-3327. Again, that's 833-424-3327, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Today's song is one of the nominations in the Best Original Score category from the film The Phantom Thread. The original score was composed by Johnny Greenwood from the band Radiohead. He scored a lot of films for director Paul Thomas Anderson. And here's the song, For the Hungry Boy.